You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eternal and Transient Elements, The Cosmic Past of Humanity and the Mystery of Evil. Collected Works, Volume 184, translated by Anna Moyse. And this is Lecture 3, given on the 8th of September, 1918. First of all, I must remind you of what we were saying yesterday, and we can then take this further. Essentially, what I said yesterday was that it is not possible to gain insight into the relationship between the ideal, or also the spiritual, on the one hand, and the material in the world, on the other, the purely causal natural order, unless one takes the real nature of human sleep into account. We started by considering Augustine's thinking, the way he wanted to gain true certainty about the world in his inner experience. Today we can no longer think like that, I said, for the simple reason that today we must know that human sleep always refutes this idea. We could never stay with the idea, in some way, that the inner experiences of human beings persist after death, that these inner experiences are truly eternal, if we had to look at the time from going to sleep to waking up the way we do in our ordinary conscious awareness today. In the ordinary conscious mind of today, we see the inner experiences grow dim in sleep. We did say, however, that as soon as someone achieves the first stage of looking into the spiritual world, they find that the human eye and astral body, that is, the actual human soul and spirit, are as much connected from within with the world of the angels, archangels, and archai as human beings are connected with the animal world, plant world, and mineral world in their waking hours. In sleep, the world's adversary powers dim down human awareness, and we are therefore unable to realize that in our sleep we are connected with the hierarchy of angels, archangels, and archai. These imbue the human eye and astral body with their own essential nature, holding and sustaining the human astral body and eye. And we told how three things have come from this connection between human beings and the hierarchic spirits. The first is that even in our ordinary state of mind, we have a more or less definite feeling of being an individual person. We know ourselves to be an I. We would never do so if we had only the powers we have in our waking hours. It is like an after-effect of our experiences in sleep, that during the day in our waking hours we do all the time feel ourselves to be an independent individual. This is because the angelic spirit, from the spiritual world of which we are part, is connected with us from going to sleep to waking up. But the archangelic spirit, or rather a number of archangelic spirits, are also connected with our soul and spirit. The after-effect of this, in our waking hours, is that we know ourselves to be members of the whole of humanity, knowing altogether that we are human beings here on earth. Every human being really has awareness of his or her independent, individual nature, even if it is not entirely distinct. Awareness that we are human is less clear-cut. We have it at the back of our mind. Some philosophers, Feuerbach, for instance, or indeed Auguste Comte, held the view that it is indeed an important discovery for human beings when they come to see themselves as human in general, as members of the whole of humanity. And we heard yesterday that Auguste Comte would speak of the Great Spirit, meaning the human being. He was, however, speaking from the point of view of ordinary materialistic science, not knowing the spiritual basis of being aware of our humanity in the background of our inner life. We would not be able to have the least idea of being human if the part of us, which in sleep is separated from our physical and ether body, were not wholly imbued with the archangelic spirit. Thirdly, we are imbued with the spirit of the age, the spirit from the hierarchy of the archai. Anything arising from this remains really quite dark, shadowy in our mind. Present-day humanity does not have it at all, except when people feel themselves to be part of history, the life of history. Oriental thinking has not at all advanced as far as this awareness of being an earthly human being. It has been the particular task of Occidental civilization to feel ourselves to be part of history, in our case, let us say, as belonging to the 19th and 20th centuries. In today's materialistic age, this does not go far beyond the year and some external historical dates. We'll hear in a minute how little this really means where real life is concerned. It needs spiritual science to make us realize how the state of the human soul changes through the millennia, how human beings change, and how we now look back on earlier times. And I know that the people of the third post-Atlantean era, the Egypto-Chaldean peoples, had a very different constitution of soul and of their humanity from the one we have today. We have this sense of being part of the whole evolution of humanity as an after-effect of our connection with the archai spirit during the time from going to sleep to waking up. From going to sleep to waking up, we should know that we are connected with this third spiritual hierarchy. How does our life from going to sleep to waking up, which happens every day, differ from our life between death and being born again? Every night as we go to sleep, we are putting our physical and ether body aside, provisionally, as it were, until revoked. The body is kept for us. We are then connected with the spirits of the third hierarchy. On waking, we return to our physical and ether body. The situation is different when we can no longer return, having died. Then our physical and ether body is given over to the drives of earthly change and development. Apparently so. We know that it is apparently so, having talked the other day about the fact that it seems to be so. As far as our experience goes, our physical and ether body is given over to the spheres of earth and sky. Yet, in the time between death and rebirth, we are not merely in contact with the spirits of the third hierarchy, the way we are in sleep, but we are in equally close contact with the spirits of the second hierarchy, the exousiai, or spirits of form, the dunamis, or spirits of movement, and the curiosities, or spirits of wisdom, and also the spirits of the first hierarchy, seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. As here on earth we direct our essential human nature toward the world, and in the world periphery, to everything to be found in the natural worlds, so will we then be aware, not outwardly but inwardly, of the higher hierarchies, having an influence between death and rebirth. From a certain point of view, this is the difference between human sleep and death. In sleep we are directly, and also indirectly, connected with the spirits of the third hierarchy. After death, with the spirits of all three hierarchies, all the way up to the most sublime spirits. With this in mind, you'll also be able to see how human beings altogether have their place in the universe, as microcosm related to the whole universe, to the macrocosm. Let us get an overview of what I have been saying. After death, our spiritual nature is inwardly connected with the spirits of the third hierarchy, those of the second hierarchy, and those of the first hierarchy, just as here it is connected with the animal, plant, and mineral worlds around us. When you get to know everything which the spirits of the third hierarchy do, in the first place, they have other things to do as well, but we are always only talking about some aspects of things, aren't we? The spirits of the third hierarchy are single individuals, each acting on its own, but through its actions also together with others. If you bring to mind what these spirits of the third hierarchy bring about, it is first of all everything, first of all, as I said, that happens in the historical life of humanity. You may also put it like this. No one knows anything about the reality of humanity's historical life unless they have some idea of the true nature of history, which in real terms is made not by human beings, but by the spirits of the third hierarchy. It is they, angels, archangels, and archai, who actually make history. Human beings take part in the work of this third hierarchy by gaining from it awareness of their individual nature, their humanity, of being historical entities on earth. Human beings have their place in the world because those spirits create historical life, and human beings do, in turn, have their inner nature and their inner connection with historical life from these spirits. Historical life all around us, history as it is generally accepted, is largely a story that has been agreed upon, a mere reflection of the inwardly historical life, the course of which is created by the spirits of the third hierarchy. We may now ask if the spirits of the second and first hierarchy also had tasks in a similar way, speaking of the exousiae, dunamis, kyriotetes, spirits of form, spirits of movement, and spirits of wisdom, respectively. Well, their task was much more comprehensive. Let us leave aside their connection with humanity to begin with. You will find it easiest to consider their task if you direct your attention to your ether body. You know, of course, that when you start from your eye and move inward, you'll first of all come to your astral body. Through the astral body, you are connected with the historical life of humanity. The spirits of the third hierarchy create and influence the historical life of humanity. But when you go further, down to the ether body, you find that this ether body is a most complex entity. In present-day human life, human beings do not know much of the whole complexity on which this human ether body is based. You will get some idea of everything which has to work on this ether body if you study titled Occult Science. There, you find how the ether body evolved from the whole cosmos in the successive Saturn, Sun, and Moon periods, consecutive embodiments of our Earth, and how the spirits of the higher hierarchies played their part in this. To put it succinctly, we may say, from a particular point of view, that everything in world evolution, a more comprehensive evolution, which our ether body is connected with, just as our astral body is connected with the historical life of humanity, is created and developed by the spirits of the second hierarchy, by exousiae, dunamis, kyriotetes. To give you a clear picture, I'll say that the spirits of the second hierarchy do all the things that influence the human ether body. This really leads to something else again. When you wake up in the morning and enter into your ether body, you are actually entering into a creature of the spirits of the second hierarchy. You also enter into your physical body, which in the ancient mysteries was called the temple of man. Anything discovered about this in anatomy and physiology really and truly is merely the absolutely outermost envelope or shell. We can only get an idea of this utterly marvelous creation, which is the human physical body, if we know that it has been created by the spirits of the first hierarchy working together. Entering into your physical body as you wake up in the morning, you are actually entering into the work of the most sublime hierarchies. Consider, therefore, how things are arranged in life. Here, between birth and death, we enter, on waking, first of all into our astral body, where the historical life of humanity takes effect. We also enter into our ether body, created by the second hierarchy. There, much of the cosmos, the etheric life in the cosmos, is at work. And we enter into our physical body, created by the spirits of the first hierarchy. In our life between death and rebirth, however, we are not living with the creation, but with the creators themselves. Here you have one of the marked differences in life between birth and death, and life between death and rebirth. As you enter into your bodily nature here, you are entering into all that is creature of the higher hierarchies. When you die, you enter into the hierarchies themselves. You move from the creature to the creators. That is the situation. Let us now ask, as we consider what has been said, what is the true nature of our earth? The things our ordinary geology or other sciences discover about the earth are again merely an outer shell. So what is the earth's true nature? You know that we have our physical body in common with the whole mineral world, and in the waking state we are within a part of the earth. We have our ether body in common with the whole plant world, and in this respect are within a second part of our earth. We have our astral body in common with the animal world, the I we have for ourselves. We are thus within the three worlds on our earth, and they really make up the whole of our earth. It is the ground we stand on, as it were, not physically, but in our essential human nature. It is something that cannot be seen. It stays supersensible. It is the ground we stand on, and the mineral world is its lowest part. The mineral world is the lowest part of this ground we base ourselves on. You'll remember from occult science that the mineral world did not exist in earlier embodiments of our earth. The moon did not yet have a mineral world, nor did the old sun, nor indeed old Saturn. You can read it up in occult science. The mineral world only evolved on earth, the fourth stage of earth evolution. I ask you to remember this. It is a difficult matter, but it is extraordinarily important. There had to be three prior stages before the mineral earth evolved. We call these three stages the three elemental realms, with the mineral world the fourth. We might also say about the earlier embodiments, during the Saturn embodiment of the earth, first elemental realm, during the sun embodiment of the earth, second elemental realm, parenthesis, the entities which were then mineral world had earlier been elemental realm, close parenthesis. During the moon period, not the present time, the old moon period, third elemental realm. The mineral world arose as the fourth realm on progression to earth. Human beings bear this within them. To be within the mineral world is to be in the fourth development. We bear this mineral world within us, and it is this which makes us into visible entities. This mineral world is also the only one which is complete in us. When the earth will have come to an end, when it will have entered into another embodiment, human beings will be as complete in the plant world as they are in the mineral world today. They will then be in the fifth stage of development. I am saying that the earth will reach an end state and then arise anew, Jupiter period. Human beings will then relate to the plant world the way they do to the mineral world today. They will be in the fifth development. To be in the plant world is to be in the fifth development. There will be a further embodiment of our earth. We call it the Venus stage or period. Human beings will then hold their own place in the animal world. Not be animals, but be in the animal world. As you know, this is different from being an animal. To be in the animal world is to be in the sixth development. There follows the conclusion, the seventh in musical terms, in the whole process of evolution. We call this the Vulcan embodiment of the earth. Man will then have reached the highest level of his evolution. He will finally be wholly human. To be in the human realm is to be in the seventh development. And the life of man goes through a total of seven stages of development. Let us look at present-day human beings. As we have seen, they are within the mineral world. They are not yet in the plant world. Life will be very different for them when they will be in the plant world. They will not feel themselves to be individuals, but members of the whole of humanity. They will then, for instance, find it intolerable to have a certain degree of good fortune if someone next to them is suffering misfortune. Today people feel separate from others as if they were a screen, as if there were a screen between them. This will have to be so, otherwise they would never be able to develop their individual nature. But it will be different in the Jupiter world, where human beings will be in the fifth stage of development. There they will find it utterly intolerable if one person is happy and another unhappy, for they will not feel themselves to be an organism, to put it in abstract terms. Now, they do not feel themselves to be an organism, but that is Maya, illusion. A time will come, however, when human beings will be in the plant world and will be unable to bear individual good fortune if someone else is suffering misfortune. This thought is behind the feelings of the spiritualists of whom I spoke yesterday. I told you that English spiritualists will have to fight a great battle in future times against the whole of popular English culture. The evil in this culture is utilitarianism. In Bentham's case, this utilitarianism essentially led to the principle that has been called the maximation of happiness. This utilitarianism will fill people's minds more and more, and that is why this way of thinking will only come to be spiritualized under opposition from those who are spiritually minded. That is the prospect for the future. The spiritually minded will have to overcome popular culture, vanquish it to annihilation. And so I was able to tell you that Bentham arrived at his maxim out of his nation's culture, saying that the good on earth was the happiness of the greatest number of people. His worst opponents were the spiritually minded in his own country, who told him that this was a devilish definition, one which one could only produce if one thought of nothing but the present. Thinking a little of the future in evolution, one would know that it was quite intolerable to think of the happiness of the greatest number, since the opposite to this would be the happiness of the least number, and that would have to be evil. Yet evil and happiness have nothing to do with one another. Such contradistinction will be impossible in future, when human beings will feel themselves to be within the plant world, part of the whole of humanity. Today we cannot cut away an important organ in the human body, for the whole human organism would then perish. In future, when the earth will be within the plant world, it will not be possible for a particular group of people to be suffering without the whole suffering. That will be a particular stage in evolution. Bentham gave a definition of happiness that has absolutely no future, but only a present time, and this must be fought particularly by those who seek spirituality. Yes, but why is it said to be the opposite when one says, quote, good defined by Bentham as the happiness of the greatest number, evil defined as the happiness of the lowest number? These are not opposites in abstract terms the way people see it, but spiritualists do not think in abstract, but in real terms. They do not ask, quote, what is the opposite to this, but think of the reality which evolves, and that is not usually the general way of thinking. Individuals will take part in the whole to an even greater degree when they are in the sixth stage of development, and particularly so if they are wholly human, wholly spiritualized human beings in the seventh stage. We have seen from this that the way we are now on the solid ground of our earth, we do as human beings, insofar as we are creatures, really only get as far as the fourth stage of development. We have the mineral world, and this is complete. The other worlds, the way they are today, will partly perish, and human beings will develop them in a different way. The plant world, as I have described it. We won't speak of the animal and human worlds today, but on another occasion. Today, human beings find themselves in the fourth stage of development, when they see themselves as creature among other creatures. They do, however, project into the other stages of development, for as we have seen, human beings are under the influence of the third hierarchy, even when just asleep. This hierarchy is further advanced than they are. It is today in the fifth stage of development, and the other spirits have advanced even further. Human beings thus project into the higher stages of development. I would ask you to be patient and really think these subtle thoughts through, for you must now make distinction between thinking yourself a creature and thinking yourself the independent spirit which you are in sleep. for instance, or between death and rebirth. Insofar as you do here think of yourself in your physical, in your ether body, astral body, and I, you are thinking of yourself as a creature on earth, and are in the fourth stage of development, but are projecting into the fifth, sixth, and seventh developments. As you live not just in your body, but also out of your body, in sleep or in death, you project into the other hierarchies, and those other hierarchies are more advanced. So we are able to say that if we look on the earth and everything on it, and in it as something created, then it has, as creation, developed as far as the fourth stage, and we have developed with it, also as far as the fourth stage. But since we feel ourselves to be independent individuals, human beings, feel ourselves to be part of Earth evolution, knowing that our ether body has been created by the second hierarchy and our physical body by the first hierarchy, we extend up into the other spheres, the other developmental elements. The seventh stage of development is not the end, however. Evolution continues. And since we project into the higher forms of development, we also project into an eighth form of development, the famous eighth sphere. It is reasonable to say that in a way we do extend to the eighth development, since we extend up to highly developed levels of sublime spirits, and are thus in the divine realm, or the realm of the spirits, call it what you will. We extend into this eighth development with the most subtle parts of our spiritual nature. This extension to the eighth development is a great secret, but we can get an idea of a very slight, I'd say, not very intensive projection into the eighth development if we consider the following. We know that the central point for Earth is the mystery on Golgotha. Looking back to this mystery on Golgotha, how it happened in year 1 to 33 in our calendar, in the 747th year, following the founding of Rome, we find it happened in the first third of the fourth post-Atlantean era. We refer to the time in the evolution of human civilization when it took place as the fourth post-Atlantean civilization. We know that the third period of civilization preceded the Greco-Roman period. We are now in the fifth, for the fourth, in which the mystery on Golgotha took place, ended in the 15th century. We are now in the first third of the fifth post-Atlantean period of civilization. Humanity evolves through the periods of civilization, but when we speak of them, we are actually speaking of something in which human beings are not wholly involved. All of you are bound to have been incarnated in the ancient Egypto-Chaldean period, which was the third post-Atlantean age, then again in the Greco-Roman period, and now in the present one. But you only ever live through 80 years, if you reach the age of 80, all things being well, of the period. And there is a much longer period of time between your incarnations, the period from death to rebirth. Human beings thus share only part of the successive periods of Earth evolution. You may say, of course, quote, well, human beings only go through part of it in their physical body, but it is not for nothing that they live in a physical body. They experience the world from the standpoint of the physical body because they would not be able to have the experiences which they have in the physical body when they are between death and rebirth. Close quote. Now, anything experienced between death and rebirth, when human beings are in the purely spiritual world, may be rated more or less highly. We won't go into this today, but it is different from the things human beings experience here through their physical bodies. Always in episodes of human evolution as a whole. They would not be able to experience them if it were not for development in the living body. People have quite the wrong idea when they are ascetic about the development of the body on earth, seeing it as an enemy of the higher human being. That is not so. It is something which gives human beings something which they cannot gain in any other way. Someone who despises life in the body, considering it to be something inferior, is utterly mistaken, for it signifies something most sublime, most important in human life as a whole. Spiritual science cannot go with the mysticism or that wrong direction in Christianity, not the right but the wrong direction, where people despise what they call the mundane world. Human beings experience the world from a different angle between death and rebirth. They experience it in the way in which they are able, and with now the creators themselves influencing them and not the creations which influence them through physical body and ether body. It is a different experience. It is because of this that we need to get to know not only the things perceived through the senses, but also the supersensible during our time on earth. We cannot get to know the historical life of humanity, which results from the efforts of the third hierarchy, from the point of view we have in life on earth. And for our time, please note that I am saying for our time, for it was not so in pre-Christian times, for our time, it is most important that human beings become aware that if they want to get to know themselves as part of history whilst here on earth between birth and death, they must also come to know what the angels, archangels, and archai bring about as historical life. Getting to know the world only in the way natural scientists seek to know it today, getting to know the world the way it is described in history, as if history were made solely by people and not by the spirits of the third hierarchy, is to get to know only the outermost layers of historical evolution. History can only be known by someone who is aware that whilst here in a physical body, he must, as it were, see what the spirits are doing on earth, which he gets to know in a very different way between death and rebirth, if I may use a term which has to be relative, personally, individually, in their heavenly deeds. We have to get to know their influence on historical life on earth. But it has not always been the way it is now, in the age in which we live. Above all, it was not like this in the third post-Atlantean era, before the year 747, in Egypto-Chaldean times. We know that people's whole inner life, the whole state of their soul, was different then. Life from beyond the earth shone into ordinary human life, and people knew, though their interpretation was different from the one which we use in mythologies, that the spirits of the third hierarchy influenced their eye and their astral body. They meant the spirits of the third hierarchies, though they called them Osiris, or Zeus, or Apollo, or Minerva, or whatever. They knew that those spirits, they merely thought them out and interpreted them, but the figures thought out and interpreted actually were those spirits, had an influence. They might not have wanted to see them, but they did see them inwardly, for in those early times the mind was not deluded the way it is today. Only the delusion about life existed, anthropomorphizing those figures, as it is said. People knew of those figures, however. This is one of those points which changed the whole life of humanity. Today people do not know in their ordinary state of mind what plays into their lives. Man was born with a soul in that third post-Atlantean era, was born again in the fourth post-Atlantean era, and again in our time. Human beings do not perceive what the spirits of the third hierarchy bring about as historical life, but they should get to know it. They really should. The people of earlier times came to know it in its mythological form. Let us enter into such a human soul. There are more incarnations, as you know, but let us take three successive incarnations, one Egyptian, one Greek, and one from the fifth post-Atlantean period of civilization. In the third, the Egypto-Chaldean period of civilization, that soul experienced the things which it could then experience because the spirits of the third hierarchy influenced life. This gradually dimmed down. Some would still experience it in the fourth, the Greco-Roman period. Many still experienced it in the proper way, especially until the year 333, after the mystery on Golgotha. Then it gradually disappeared. People then had to limit themselves more and more to the sense-perceptible world around them, unless they went through such inner development that they came to know the spiritual world by another route, and were thus able to ascend to the spirits of the third hierarchy. If we look at such a soul as it now returns again, it comes with everything it had taken in during the third post-Atlantean era, in the Egypto-Chaldean period of civilization. But let us assume that such a soul refuses, in the present incarnation, to consider the involvement of the third hierarchy in the historical life of humanity, saying to itself, quote, "What concern is it of mine what angels, archangels, and archai have done? To me, history is something which human beings have done at all times here on earth." Close quote. Such a soul does not take into account that the deeds of the third hierarchy have played a part in everything human beings have done on earth. Let us now assume, for clarity's sake, for some souls it also applies with regard to the fourth era, the Greco-Roman period, up to the year 333. But for clarity's sake, let us assume such a soul has come from the Egypto-Chaldean period. Then it needed no effort to know something about the involvement of the third hierarchy, for this was a natural part of human life, and the soul would still bear this within it. Let us say, therefore, that the soul bears within it anything which it had been able to take in at that time. You would not have been able to tell an ancient Egyptian about this historical life. He would have had no real concept of historical life, that human beings make history. He would have laughed at this, for he could see that the spirits of the third hierarchy were making the history, though he would think of them in his own inward way. In this day and age, people bear all this within them, but unconsciously so. It has gone down into the subconscious. They now believe that history is something which people on earth have made. This creates a strange state of soul, and I'd ask you to let this be very clear in your minds. Looking at such a soul in the present time, we would say that it refuses to take its place in a real way in humanity's historical life. It says, quote, "I do not want to know of the involvement of the archai, archangels, and angels. I only want to know from physical evidence what people have been doing from those ancient times." Close quote. But a soul cannot develop further as a result, but will in reality remain at the point where it was in ancient Egyptian times. It will have the maturity only of a soul in ancient Egyptian times. It is not prepared to take hold of reality. The angels, archangels, and archai have continued to develop. They have done the things which humanity has since been able to experience. Such a soul will say, quote, "What the hierarchies have done up there in the spiritual world is something I'll not concern myself with. I'll concern myself solely with my own abilities." Close quote. Those abilities are, however, none other than those which it already had in ancient Egyptian times. Numerous such souls live in the present time. Consider the strange position such a soul is in. Up to the year 333, a soul could not get into this position, for the spiritual world was still coming in of its own accord. Now, however, souls may be in a strange position. They cannot refuse to accept reality. They are, of course, within the deeds of the angels, archangels, and archai, but they deny this in their minds, accepting only the things which human beings have brought about here on earth. This is a case where people, as creatures, are in the fourth stage of development. That stage involved everything which happens in creation. Since Egyptian times, therefore, everything human beings have done on earth is part of the growth stage of development. But man himself extends beyond this. And because he has not been able to extend consciously into the realms into which he does extend, he is in his essential nature actually above the seventh stage of development. He is there within the eighth stage of development. It is possible today for souls to be actually in the eighth stage of development, but fail to accept this because they do not acknowledge the work of the angels, archangels, and archai in human history. They acknowledge only the fourth stage, and so the eighth sphere remains unconscious within them. This is an extraordinarily important fact. When a soul in this position develops a philosophy of life, what will it be? The individual ignores his own reality. He does not admit that he projects into a sublime realm of the spirit, although he does, in fact, do so. He only admits that he is in the human realm. This stage of soul has only emerged clearly in the industrial age, as I have called it. It has only been since people were wholly in the industrial life that they came to ignore the fact, in their philosophy of life, that human beings extend up into the spiritual world, taking account only of the outward activities of human beings. This is something significant. We cannot understand the present if we do not know that there are numerous people today who extend into the eighth sphere with their philosophy of life, but ignore this fact. They cause all the damage on earth which comes about when one extends into a sphere but denies its existence. By denying that they extend into the eighth sphere, into the eighth stage of development, man excludes himself from the good of this stage and gives himself over to the Ahamanic spirit of the developmental stage concerned. His thinking becomes Ahamanic rather than divine or spiritual. Speaking of spiritual science, one must point to the facts, the truth of that world. The truth is that something like the materialistic view of history of Karl Marx, for instance, who lived from 1818 to 1883, his philosophy of life, is wholly Ahamanic. The secret of that philosophy of life is that the projection of man's spiritual nature into the supersensible worlds is ignored, and that because of this the human being falls prey to the Ahamanic powers. As soon as human beings exclude their conscious awareness from the worlds into which they project, they fall prey to the Ahamanic or Luciferic powers, in this case the Ahamanic powers. It is a fact that today very many people represent and fight for a purely Ahamanic philosophy of life. In doing so, they evoke everything that will have to happen if the Ahamanic rather than the divine order spreads over the globe. Bentham's philosophy, which I spoke of yesterday, is initially an external theoretical version of this Ahamanic view. Marxism is another version, and is also creative, configuring, and tremendously influential. People living a middle-class life, slow to change, know nothing of this, and for decades have not concerned themselves with the elements of such philosophies which have developed in the social sphere. Marxism is an extreme version of this. It will continue to have an influence. Something which initially was meant to be just knowledge will be happening in life, to be absolute reality. Only one thing can be a help in this situation, and that is insight, insight which generates a will to act. Truths like these mean radical changes and are definitely not suitable for making your Sundays more exciting. Truths like these are deep down, connected with the whole of present cultural life. Much will depend on people being prepared to consider the things that live in their thoughts in connection with the whole world order. For we have now entered into the cycle of time where we will not progress without getting into horrific disasters, unless we realize how something which happens within the human being relates to developments in the whole cosmos. Truths like these, when you find them in your search for truth, you can be assured of this, will be rather a shock at first. If you have a feeling for the way in which great truths bring great change in the world, you will also know the shock they may be. Only superficial minds might think that it does not shock one to have to say, quote, Ahriman is pulsating through people who many others thought, close quote, and it was of course also true, continue quote, were honestly endeavoring to discover the truth, close quote. It touches the heart, my dear friends. And when such truths are found, one tries to cope with them. They are not made to go in one ear and out the other. Nor are they made to be found in solitary meditation and accepted as sensational. None of these truths are for such purposes. One has to cope with them. One must be able to discover how world evolution, as it is called, being there all around one, also in people's opinions, is in accord with the existence of such truths. Someone like myself, who has seen how many people today, people can nowadays convince themselves of this through external facts, live with Marxism or Marxism-type views, will certainly consider it necessary to go more into these things. There one will often say to oneself, quote, perhaps you are nevertheless under an illusion, close quote. We need not put the whole of the spiritual world into immediate doubt, of course not. But when it comes to such concrete truths, one does often say to oneself, quote, maybe you are under some kind of illusion here, close quote. The profound sense of responsibility concerning truth must, of course, arise particularly when they are spiritual truths. One then tries to go deeper and deeper. In fact, however, there are not few but very many things that provide dreadful confirmation of what I have just been presenting, as the Ahrimanic nature of Marxism, for instance, and similar philosophies of life. A while ago, when I was speaking to you, I did rather challenge you. I said that time, as we experience it, is really a delusion, and is in reality something quite different from people's experience. This, I said, was so because people did not see time in perspective. They experience space in perspective. Trees that are further away look smaller than those nearby. We really must see time in perspective as well. Events further away in time must be seen differently from those closer to the present. The basis for this is that time truly is what investigators have always thought it to be, the most important medium for deceiving humanity. We imagine that the spirits of the higher hierarchies also move through time the way our own inner life does. This is untrue. In reality, the essential nature of the higher hierarchies lies in times past, but they exert their influence from times past. Just as in space it is possible to have a distant influence using light signals or the like to influence others who are not too far away. Time is not what people think it is, nor is it what philosophers like Kant consider it to be. In reality, time is something quite different. Human beings think it is real, but it is another maya, a great delusion. Above all, things which we think in our delusion about time to be in the past actually continue to exist. Time truly turns into something rather like a space. To see things as they really are, one does not look on past events the way one does at objects in space. Time deceives us. We know from spiritual science that the wellsprings of other great delusions in human philosophies of life arise because of the illusion about time. If there were any physicists among you, I would be able to use the language of physics here. I would be able to show you, using physical formulas, that when physicists use time, T in short, in their formulas, that time is just a number, something quite unknown, therefore, not anything real, but quite unreal. Only velocity is always real. But physicists see velocity as a consequence of time. You are not physicists, however, and unlikely to put your minds to this, and so I will not go into this any further. Time is delusion, which is a truth of great import. For the fact that time is delusion is the basis of many other delusions in life. We see everything the wrong way. For example, if we use time in the wrong way with regard to history. People tend to think that certain things that happened in the first three Christian centuries are now in the past. In reality, they ought to think, quote, the archangel or the spirit from the hierarchy of the Archai, which guided events at that time, is still here. This continues to have an effect in another way. Close quote. Being past and gone is a delusion. Much depends on it that we get to know the perspective nature of time when it comes to spiritual reality, knowing that we have to be deceived about events in time just as, not believing this, we are deceived about events in space unless we allow for perspective. Just think how great the delusion would be if you were not to accept perspective, considering something distant in space to have the same power to affect you as something close by. You are looking at a distant mountain. Your health depends a great deal on the air around you and not on the air on the distant mountain. If you want that air to improve your health, you'll have to go there. Essentially, reality has to do with perspective when it comes to reality in life. And it is the same with regard to time. We are living in the right way in the present time if we do not think that events in the more distant past carry the same weight as more recent events. If we consider the Egypto-Chaldean period in the third post-Atlantean era, limiting ourselves to surviving documents and record them the way history written by fools does, the agreed-upon fable which they call history today, we are making the mistake in perspective. It really is of no significance in the present day what people did in Egyptian times. But the things which the angels, archangels, and archai did, those are important. This will only emerge, however, if we use perspective. It is therefore a basic principle in spiritual investigation, not only today, when we have to rediscover all these things, but it has always been a principle that time as such is Maya. No one who knows the true nature of time has ever reckoned with time in such a way that it was taken to be true, that time itself was taken to be a genuine reality. The strange thing which emerged was that Karl Marx, I have spoken of him, and millions swear by him today, though more or less in nuances, more or less in formulas, but that does not matter. Karl Marx tried to answer the question, quote, what are the things of true value for humanity? What is it that is truly achieved in humanity? Close quote. He answered this question in an extraordinarily original way, for it had never been answered like this before. People had always looked at true value in some other way, not the way Karl Marx did. People would consider things to be of value to humanity, let us say, according to whether they had to be transported through long distances, if much intelligence had been needed to find them, etc. I once tried to explain this to you by saying that human labor must also be considered in qualitative terms, and one must altogether look at it in a very concrete way. We consider the engineering marvel of the St. Gotthard Tunnel. No one can build such a tunnel unless they know differential and integral calculus. Differential and integral calculus was invented by Leibniz, or, if this makes the English more happy, by Newton. The two of them were in dispute over the invention. We may say, therefore, that Newton or Leibniz also worked on the St. Gotthard Tunnel. It certainly could not have been built without them. One has to put quite a different value on the work of Newton or Leibniz than one would on the work of someone who put one stone on another in the tunnel. This is a point to be considered in putting a value on human work, something of value for humanity. The theory of the value of human labor has taken different forms. Values have been put on labor, something of value in life, from all kinds of different points of view, but never in the way in which Karl Marx did it. He included just one element in his theory of value. To him, everything that had value in human life had value only because it was condensed time, especially condensed working hours. The economic value, the value in the world economy, was measured in whether it could be produced in 3, 6, or 12 hours. A major part of Marx's theory was based on this. The theory is so widely accepted today that you may find that when a member of a higher class is speaking about labor from his point of view, a worker will get up, a real socialist, and say, please read it up in Karl Marx. He would not have to have the book with him, of course. Page 374, and there you'll find this or that. To judge life, we must really know it, or we will find there are constant surprises with one thing happening or another. The things that happen arise from impulses in the human soul. However, if one cares as little as people have in recent decades, have been caring, about what was really happening deep down in the human soul, one should not be surprised when the whole finally collapses and one faces disaster. I've been saying these things for a particular reason. It was the first time that very original something, which is but the source of deception, was made the measure of all economic values, time in form of working hours. Take this from the standpoint of a higher perspective. People with insight into reality have always known that time is deceptive. Now someone comes along and says, quote, but the things that are of value in the world have only as much value as the condensed working hours in it, close quote. Surely this means, in other words, quote, your reality is therefore illusion, and only condensed time for labor has real value, close quote. The people who want to be wholly materialistic, only basing themselves on reality, make the deception into reality, even in the form which they give to time, and reality is overlooked. This is just one example. I could give you many examples of things that are a comfort when one is taken aback by truths which strike like rolls of thunder if one has a heart for the life of humanity. But when one then studies these things in detail, when one focuses on someone like Karl Marx, knowing that his spirit was an Ahrimanic influence, and asks him, quote, how does this go in detail, close quote, one will indeed arrive at the Ahrimanic element and feel that these are truths one may admit to oneself. Basically, it is not easy to have to say to oneself that everything that is anachronism in the world today is coming into our world because people take a position which is outside the spiritual world, and which then becomes the eighth sphere for them, and because they take the world only from the creature point of view. Here you will indeed realize in all its gravity what it means when I stress over and over again that it does not matter at all if someone speaks of something beautiful, something one is able to accept. What matters is what actually becomes of those good things said. Again and again I have to draw attention, you know I am not saying this from some kind of silly vanity, to the fact that it does not matter what the thoughts are which we have in mind, but that we take care to see what effect these thoughts then have. You may have a truly marvelous thought, but if you have no idea of what effect that thought has in real terms, then it may well have the opposite effect. I've been trying to make this clear for years, giving examples. One example was in a lecture I gave at the beginning of the 20th century. I said, I am summing up in a few words what was a full exposition at the time, merely to illustrate my point, that more people than ever are today pacifists, talking most beautifully of guidance for humanity from their pacifist point of view. Pacifism has really never before had so many followers as today. That is what I said at the beginning of the century. I went on to say that this was a definite sign that we were about to enter into the greatest war humanity had ever known. To think as unrealistically about human situations, the way people did there, considering the subject of those thoughts only, having little awareness of the true effect of the thoughts that live in the soul, an effect one can only truly grasp by considering the whole world, that was not the way in earlier times. People are only doing so in an age when all those things of which we have been speaking are spreading. Why is it that something can actually set the tone for many people, which is no more than thought content, but completely unrealistic, something which can never have anything to do with actual events? Thus Woodrow Wilson's thoughts, no different from thought content in Egypto-Chaldean times, the thoughts of someone who does not care that there is spiritual reality in history, but merely develops a sequence of abstract thoughts. Why is this so? It is because of all the special characteristics of our time. Future historians will have to attach the name Woodrow Wilson to everything our time has produced by way of unrealistic thoughts, which have had the opposite effect. It is this which seriously affects our philosophy of life, which has to have that effect. And we must not look at it as relating to today and tomorrow, but as something we have to look at in the light of the whole of cosmology, from the point of view of having been put in that situation. Answering such questions from the point of view which arises from a worldwide view will judge someone like Woodrow Wilson not from sympathies or antipathies, but in a truly objective way. The anachronism is that many people today cannot go into this because it is uncomfortable to look things in the face. You cannot look things in the face without going into them more deeply. It has to be said that people who do not relate to historical life today are ignoring the actual history brought about by the third hierarchy. They, therefore, have nothing to do with the real impulses when they speak, but essentially are dealing only in the empty husks of words. A basic requirement in our time is that we get to know and understand that when we have the best and most beautiful ideas, perfectly adequate to explore the natural world all around us, we'll still never understand anything connected with history. History does not proceed the way natural life does. History proceeds through the activities of higher spirits. This has to be added to the other philosophies of life. Humanity lived with theocracy when people still remembered the way the theocratic order extended to their life in the past. Then came the metaphysical age, essentially developing official administrative systems in the whole world. Then came the purely materialistic age, the age of industrialists. This would take humanity into irreality, where the spirit is concerned, if it were not for the counterbalance of finding one's way again into all that is real and genuine. Though one can only contemplate this if one is able to rise to something which is hidden from people in ordinary life, in the present time cycle. We have to learn to speak of supersensible things again, if we want to speak of history. People talked a lot about historical ideas in the 19th century. Well, we all know that you can't fell a tree with ideas. The followers of Ranke and similar historians do, however, believe that humanity's historical life is brought about by ideas. It will have to be realized that this time, the merely metaphysical time, also has to be overcome. Otherwise, a philosophy will prevail that is wholly limited to things perceived through the senses. Humanity must work to come to the spiritual. They will only be able to do this if, to begin with, they at least work their way from the unreal history of sequence in time to the real process, which I'd say is particularly tangible behind the reality outwardly perceived by the senses in the case of history. People will then no longer produce social programs or the like based on ideas that relate merely to outwardly apparent life. They will once again proclaim their social programs that arise from the revelations of the spiritual world. The programs people to produce today differ a great deal from those revelations that come from the spiritual world. We'll speak of this next time. I'll continue these contemplations next Friday. They cannot be taken to their conclusion that quickly. The end of Lecture 3.